right. Well, first of all, get my little lectern back, my pulpit. That was a treat actually for me to sit and listen to someone else speak, and very difficult at the same time. If you know what I'm talking about. Does anyone have any feedback on our meeting? Anything you want to say? I thought we'd take a couple minutes, just like we normally do, to talk about that. Ivan? Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah, he was good at covering the topics that he did. Really was good at that, I thought. Ken?
Well, even though going in and you read the topics, and it seemed like they were going to be hard ones to get through, if you will, but I think they were presented just spot on.
Yeah. He did a good job, but not
softened it down too much.
Right.
He didn't make it, brimstone either.
Yeah. I think in the past that would have been a much harder lesson by different speakers.
Right. So I think it's presented just in the right way. And those types of lessons, a few of those could have been presented in ones that were directed towards new people, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, our intention was for the spring meeting to have a series directed toward Christians.
Oh, I know.
But you're right. I mean, it's not exclusive. And then in the fall, we'll have a lectureship that will be directed more toward reaching out, bringing in people, bringing in guests, and really speaking to them where they're at. Anyone else? Sarah? Yeah, he made some really good points. That Sunday morning class time that he did, I think that was really what pulled it all together. Christians in the culture, or whatever he called it. Because that's what one of his messages in that time frame was, is that, we're so concerned with what's happening in the culture, and we have this aversion. We want to separate ourselves from the culture. And then he comes along and says, but that's our mission field, which is not something foreign to what we've been saying all along, but it's good to hear it in those words. Instead of running away from those things, let's throw ourselves into the midst of that and recognize that there's a cost to that. There are challenges and sacrifices that will be made to do that, but that's what we're called to do. I mean, we're a called people. We're called out of the world to not separate ourselves from all those who are in sin, but rather to provide representation for their benefit.
Well, and it was also nice to know that sometimes we get locked up in our own little world here and don't realize that, well, this is having to be dealt with nationwide.
Yeah.
They're dealing with the same things we are. Maybe not to some extent. It's going to vary, to how much you're having to deal with things.
It's true.
Culture mentality is not just here in this state. Sometimes we might get in locked into that. It's not just us.
Yeah. I mean, I spent a lot of time talking to Matthew. We went to the FC lectureship together, or at least we spent a lot of time there together, and had a lot of time to talk, and he's got the same problems we got in his congregation. The only thing he's got that we don't have is more people to throw at the problems. He's got 250 people, roughly, rather than what we have. So there is more human resources. But the problems are the same. The solutions are the same, in essence, too. And I did like his emphasis on Christians bringing solutions, not just identifying problems. Anyone can throw rocks at a situation and walk away, but to bring solutions, that requires a different level of participation. And we need that. We need to see that. Right. Not to build up walls, but rather reach across, and help those people. Going to be tough because those people are not lovable. right? As he said, they're just not. They're not always lovable. Sometimes they are, you know, sometimes they're easy to love and easy to help, but sometimes they're just not. And that makes it tough there. Nita?
Well, the other thing is that we seem to be so fearful about what is happening in our culture and our society, and he took that right out of me. It's like, what's to be afraid of? You know, God is here. He's in charge.
Yeah.
He's given us a job to do, and we just need to focus on that and do it, and things will happen.
Well, my opinion, for what it's worth, is that we can't, because we're human, we can't be fearless, 100% fearless. But we can recognize that our fears are not what's to control us. You know, our faith is what should be up in front, and that faith should be in a power greater than what we're facing here in the world, right? Greater is he who is with you than is he who is within the world, right? 1 John 4, what is that, about verse 4? Somewhere in there. Jim?
Remember that first lesson? How he started that off with the quotes from...
Yeah, the presidents.
And I thought, wow, how far we have come as people. And, you know, you just try to put that together. You want to go out and fight that battle. Like, we need to go back.
Yeah, I was looking for quotes from our current president along that lines and didn't find anything. But you're right. I mean, it's not just our current president. It's been the last number of decades that we rarely see any kind of true belief in God. And I mean, presidents say that, but to really show that, I think, in my memory, Reagan was the last one that seemed to mean it. And that was a long time ago. I mean, that was a long time ago. So, yeah, it's hard to deal with that. Getting back to our class on Revelation, if you think about it, and we've said this before, we know how it all ends. Right? I mean, we're just... You look at where we left off last time we met, the end of Revelation 19, the beast that was terrorizing the Christians and persecuting the saints, the false prophet, those who had, or the image of the beast, rather, as well, they're all thrown into the fire. They're all destroyed. And then we have Satan himself, who is bound. And I'll explain to the best of my ability what I think that means. But the idea here is that God is most certainly in control. And that's not just something that we say and keep repeating until we try to believe it. That's something that we really have to believe up front, that God is in control. Sometimes we say it and we want to believe it, but we don't act that out. If you say that God's in control, but you or I are cowering in our church buildings, afraid to engage the culture, afraid to say anything, to talk to people, to you know, testify of your faith, well, then those statements are going in two different directions. So if God is in control, then we can speak with boldness, and we can speak as we should. John? That's right. I thought what he said about, you know, that nobody converts anybody through social media, basically, I thought that was spot on. You know, we all think that we're going to post our meme and that'll teach them, right? And we'll convert about 20 or 50 liberals or something, whatever's in our mind there. And the liberals are doing the same thing, right? Oh, teach those conservatives. And the fact is, nobody's changing their mind about anything. Not through that means, anyway. So there's got to be a better way. There's just got to be a better way than using social media as a venting forum. Because that's really all it becomes. And I've said this before, even if you posted something very rational and reasonable on social media, it takes about two, maybe three steps into the conversation thread, and already you're into irrationality, feelings, emotions, and all kinds of supposition that has nothing to do with what you said, and it's just all blown to pieces. It doesn't take long, okay? So that's just the way it is, and so let's not use that then to think that we're actually, I'm proclaiming the gospel because I posted a meme on Facebook or whatever. It's like, no, that's not how you do that. All right, Larissa?
Well, along those lines, yeah. Obviously, I handle most of the advertising that we do on social media. So that's just something that I'm working on. But the very first campaign that we did, I remember getting irritated or discouraged every time a negative comment was said or something. And now it's just kind of almost funny in a way because we.
Right.
I know.
Yeah.
Just.
Yeah. Just scroll on by. Just scroll by. It's okay. So yeah, you're right. We get all kinds of weird stuff in response. That's not all made public, is it? I can't. Good, good. Yeah, because we get some bizarre stuff. I mean, people just, you're saying something over here about a meeting, like here's our advertisement, and they just go off on something that, you guys are the child molesters. Oh, yeah, because I know a pastor that molested children, and that's what you guys have. You have youth pastors that molest children. For one, we don't have youth pastors, and we're not molesting children, and what in the world does that have to do with what we're talking about? So it's just that, it's that bizarre. It's just that crazy. And yet that's the world we're dealing with. So the best we can do is just roll with it, do our best, get the message out there as best we can. And the honest hearts will listen. The honest hearts will be drawn to us. John? That's right. You're right. Okay, it's not about politics. He made a comment, and we talk more privately about that later, about how, especially since the shutdown, Christians have become very political. And some Christians or some churches even have, they were political, and we talked about this too in our little meeting. They were political because they had to be. We were political because we had to deal with the politics of masks and shutdowns and all that stuff. But we got away from that just as quickly as we could. Other churches are still there. They're still there 3 years later. And they are just immersed in this politicized environment that everything that comes off out of the pulpit is some form of politics, and that is just not right. That's just not the way it should be. All right, Nita, and then we'll go on to our class.
I don't know whether you heard Marianne when you asked.
I did not.
Comments about the meeting. She said it was wonderful.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. On behalf of Matthew and all the efforts of everyone involved, that's great to hear. I thought it was a wonderful meeting too. I really do. That's probably one of the best meetings from a visiting preacher that we've had in memory for me. And I've been here for like 600 years. So that's saying a lot. All right, let's get back to our text. I did want to say something. I told you we had a little cliffhanger, right, at the end of class last week. Does anyone remember the cliffhanger? You came anyway. Okay, no, it's okay. It's talking here about the beast being seized and the false prophet thrown alive into the lake of fire. And this indicates, if you're looking at your notes, page 21 at the top says, this indicates not an annihilation, but a never-ending punishment. And the same will be true in the end of chapter 20, when we see those who accepted the mark of the beast also being thrown into the fire, as well as Satan himself. Again, indicating not an annihilation, but a never-ending punishment. We did teach that, or we talked about that rather, just a little bit, that there is nothing in Scripture that supports the annihilation of the soul. What I mean by the annihilation is that someone would simply cease to have any consciousness, any existence at all. They just disappear. Now, there are many who believe that in the world today. Atheists have to believe that. They have nowhere else to go. Evolutionists have to believe that because they have nowhere else to go. Okay? I mean, if an evolutionist talks about an afterlife, then that begs the question of how in the world did evolution create an afterlife that is intangible and immaterial and non-mechanical? It just blows their whole theory out of the water. So there's people that have to go that way just because of what they've chosen to believe. But the thing I wanted to focus on here, too, is that there cannot be a punishment if a soul is annihilated and has no conscious awareness. So what we're seeing with people who are thrown into this fire, whatever that fire is, whether it's symbolic or just looks like fire or feels like fire, or I don't know, I don't want to find out, but whatever this fire is, it is meant to be a punishment. Okay? And so if there was annihilation and you throw people into the fire after they're annihilated, like they lose consciousness, but you throw the body in, that's like beating up a corpse, right? I mean, nothing's being done. There's no punishment there. You know, it may feel good for the one, you know, beating it up, but it does nothing for the retribution that is due that person. And that's what God is saying here in so many words, that those who choose to ally themselves with this beast, obviously I'm jumping ahead to the end of chapter 20, those who choose to ally themselves with the beast, the false prophet, Satan himself, they are not going to just disappear out of existence. They are going to face punishment. And that punishment is a never-ending punishment. And when we talk about eternity, whether it's about heaven or about hell, never-ending doesn't mean, it has nothing to do with number of years into the future. Like someone would think, well, you know, for 10,000 or 100,000 or a million years in the future, it's not about that. Because there is no time in these situations, in these contexts. It's really just about a condition that just simply doesn't stop. It just never stops. There's no relief from it. Or in the case of those who go to heaven and enjoy eternal life, there is no having to stop it or having to leave it or thinking that it's going to end. So it's really not about counting the years into eternity. It's more about just simply a condition that never changes. It doesn't ever relent. There's no change in whatever that person is facing when they're thrown into that. So that's my thoughts for what it's worth. I know that there are Christians in other congregations, because I've talked to them, that believe that hell is limited. That there are some who teach that hell is kind of almost like a purgatory. And this varies here, it kind of burns off your sins, so to speak, like Catholicism teaches of purgatory, and then you enter into heaven after all that. You've kind of paid your dues, if you will. You've paid for your own sins. Or others, and this is more popular, that simply you endure hell for a while, but then you're annihilated. Okay, then you cease to be. And again, what does that do? What does that prove? I mean, so God took it out on these people, as someone might say, and then obliterated them out of existence. There's some real problems with that. There's theological problems with that. There's moral problems with that. There's biblical problems with that. Because, quite honestly, the Bible just doesn't say that. It's kind of like theistic evolution, you know, where you try to marry together God creating the world, or at least creating the Big Bang, and then it all evolved from there. It's like, that's a convenient theory, except that the Bible doesn't say that. It says something very different. And when it comes to heaven or hell, when it comes to the eternity to come for the souls that enter into that eternity, it's either this direction or that direction, never ending, conditions never changing. And that's all it says. So I will say, if God has other plans other than what he's disclosed here, he just hasn't told us. So it may be something like that, but that's not what he said. It's kind of like, you know, we say about baptism. If God is going to save someone who's not been baptized based on other factors, then that's his prerogative. But that's not what he said, right? What he said is what we teach. And so whatever he says is what we teach. We don't have the right to speculate otherwise, and then to use that speculation as a new doctrine or a changed doctrine from what he has said. I hope I'm making that really clear, because that's so important to make clear. Warren, what do you got?
Well, I know Christians who believe that, and it's based on their unbalanced view of God.
Yes.
God is love, and therefore love dictates the only punishment for a while.
Right.
That's it. But a balanced view of God says he's a just God and demands payment for it.
Right. Right. That's true. I mean, there are some difficult questions that remain unanswered about punishment and hell and all that stuff, and I'm not here to answer them for you. I have some of the same questions, but at the same time, we have to respect what has been revealed to us, is the point I'm trying to make. And if we don't respect that, then we're just flying blind and we're just making stuff up. I mean, if we stop respecting what has been told to us by the Holy Spirit, then we're not being true to the Holy Spirit. So that's important. That's a really important thing to say. So let's just say that there are aspects of eternity that we just will never understand, whether it's on the punishment side or on the reward side. We'll just never understand fully in this life. And I don't believe we are meant to understand it fully. We're just meant to be faithful until death, right? Revelation 2, verse 10, be faithful till death and you'll get the crown of life. Well, what if you don't be faithful till death? Well, then you get what you get, right? I mean, then you get what you really deserve in that case. We don't deserve a crown of life. What we deserve is that punishment. But if we're faithful till death, Jesus promises to give us something beyond what we deserve, which is what mercy and grace is all about. And thank goodness for that. Yeah, that's what I said.
So how do they even address that in saying, well, it's going to be a limited amount of time? There's no time.
It's not my view, so I'm not going to try to apologize for it. I just telling you what they tell me. I'm telling you what people have said, what Christians have said. So that's just where people are. You know, and if we're all sitting down over coffee and we're speculating about, hey, what do you think about this? And I'm sipping my coffee, say, here's where I'm at, right? That's one thing. But if I'm going to be the teacher, then I can't sit there and use those same speculations or that same opportunity to say, well, you know, this is, I know what God said here, but this is what Chad says, and I'm probably just as right as God, right? I mean, or come across in that way. That's just a bad place to be. And that's a, you know, talk about, I'm thinking James 3:1, let not many of you be teachers, right? There's a stricter judgment, and I don't mean like judgment in hell as much as just there's a stricter criterion that is required for such people, and we need to know when to keep our mouth shut, basically. Right? Okay, so say whatever God says, say that. Whatever God doesn't say, then you need to characterize that as, this is my opinion, or just keep your mouth shut altogether. That just might be the way to handle that sometimes there. All right, let's look at chapter 20. In chapter 20, we see this angel coming down from heaven. This is a vision, remember. John is seeing all this happening, and coming down from heaven indicates, of course, that where is John in the vision? Somewhere between here and heaven, probably here on earth, right? I mean, there's times when he says, and I saw in heaven, and then there's other times when he says, I saw on the earth. So in this case, he's probably on the earth, holding the key, it says, of this angel, the key to the abyss. Now, if you want to recall chapter 9, it talks about the abyss and that Apollyon, remember, the destroyer comes out of the abyss, and he wasn't identified as Satan at the time. Remember, I said that those chapters, Satan is barely mentioned at all, and then only indirectly. But now he's been mentioned and directly and identified, and so he has the key to this abyss and a great chain. Okay, so is this actually happening as John sees it? Is this literal? Is the key literal? Is there a giant abyss on earth? Okay, and is there a great chain, literally, that combines Satan? This is all figurative. That's, you have to accept that. That's because the context is telling you that. Remember, it's the context that drives the narrative or drives, you know, the situation here, rather than us driving the context. So the context is that this is all still within the visionary context or the visionary scene that John has been seeing all this time. And he laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan. Wow, that's a pretty broad description there of Satan. Different names, different identities, different capacities, if you will, of how he has operated. And bound him for 1,000 years. Was Satan literally bound with a chain? Was he literally bound for literally 1,000 years? Again, 1,000 years is meaning, as you see in your notes there, it just means a long, indefinite time. Or a long, but I should say, a long time, but with an end. I mean, it is not forever. It's just a long time. And he threw him, Satan, into the abyss and shut it and sealed it over them that he would not deceive the nations any longer until that 1,000 years were completed. So that tells you something here, and there's a reason why Satan is being bound. And it's because he was given the ability and the latitude, the permission to go out and deceive the nations. And if you really want to understand that, then you have to go to a passage like, for example, 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 10. He's talking about Satan and the powers, the signs, the false wonders that Satan produces in the nations, and with all deception of wickedness for those who perish because, and this is key, they did not receive the love of the truth so as to be saved, and for this reason God will send upon them a deluding influence so that they'll believe what is false, in order that they may be judged who did not believe in the truth but took pleasure in wickedness. In other words, what God is doing is giving people an opportunity to choose between truth and lies and goodness and evil. And these people are choosing the lies and evil. They're willfully, deliberately, consciously choosing to oppose God. And that's why it says that they may be judged for making that decision. So God is allowing Satan the latitude, the permission to go out and deceive the nations. But the fact is, the nations are already deceived. They've already been deceived. They've deceived themselves. They've already chosen to believe in lies rather than the truth. So Satan is just furthering what they've already started within themselves individually. And so that's what we need to understand when we read something like we just did in Revelation 20 here, that Satan didn't take a bunch of pure, innocent nations and corrupt them. Okay? Quite the opposite. These nations were already corrupted. They're already deceived, self-deceived. They're already immersed in idolatry and paganism and sorcery and kinds of immorality that Matthew was describing here that's going on in our country today. They're already there. And Satan just took advantage of that or of them in that situation and further deceived them into worshiping this beast and then the false prophet and then the image of the beast. So it's not like Satan just walked into, say, a church building and then conned everybody. And we just kind of blindly went, oh, okay, we'll follow Satan, right? Without any will to resist him. That's not what happened at all. In fact, there's one group of people that Satan didn't deceive, and that would be the Christians. Remember back in chapter 12 when Satan sent this big water into the world and the world drank up the water. It was meant to flood the church, so to speak, but it ended up the world drank up the water, this big flood, and the flood was the lies and the deceptions. So it wasn't the church that ate up all the lies and the deceptions. It was the world itself. And so he is not going to be given that permission any longer for this thousand-year period of time, however long it truly is. And after these things, it says he must be released for a short time. I would say, my opinion is, short in comparison to the thousand years. So whatever the thousand years was, a long stretch of time, he'll be released at the end of that, but it'll be for a very brief time in comparison. That's how I read that. If you read that differently, I'm not going to fight you. I'm not going to argue with you, okay? But I am trying to stay the context. Short time has to have some kind of connection to what is being said here. And then verse 4, then I saw thrones, and they sat on them, and judgment was given to them. And I saw the souls of those who had been beheaded because of their testimony of Jesus and the word of God, and those who had not worshipped the beast or his image, and had not received the mark on their forehead and hand. They came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. The question would be up front is, where are these thrones being set up? Are they in heaven or are they on earth? What would be the most logical, natural conclusion to this? In heaven. Okay? Because we see no such thrones being set up on earth. Christians aren't given thrones, at least not in this context. And these thrones are meant to judge, or really to stand in judgment. And that doesn't mean that they have the right to consign someone to hell or anything like that. That's not what judgment means here. It is very much the same way as when Jesus said in Luke chapter 4 that the sons of Nineveh, the people of Nineveh, will rise up in judgment against this generation. That doesn't mean that in the hereafter, all the people of Nineveh will get a chance to send all the unfaithful Jews to hell. That doesn't mean that. What it does mean, though, is that by the decision that those people made of Nineveh, that is, to repent when they heard the message of God, they will accuse and testify against the people of Jerusalem and Israel in general for having not repented, even though the Son of God was right there in their midst. And the same said about the Queen of Sheba later on, that the Queen of Sheba will rise up in judgment against this generation. I mean, she saw Solomon and heard his wisdom and saw his splendor and was amazed by all the glory surrounding him, and she was just overwhelmed with that and knew that God was with him. And yet here we have the Son of God walking among the Israelites, and the first thing that they want to do when he doesn't fulfill their expectations is they want to kill him. And so the Queen of Sheba will rise up in judgment. Well, that's what this judgment is like. That these Christians here who are given thrones are not given thrones to render final determinations or render final convictions. But they are given thrones to weigh against in a court of law, like sitting in the docket in a court of law where you are testifying against someone. Does that make sense? Because we have no indication that they are involved in the judgment process other than that. Absolutely zero indication at all. But they do have every right to stand up and accuse the generation in which they lived on earth and say, we made a decision based on the same facts that you were given. We made a decision to follow Christ. You had that same opportunity. You refused and decided to follow Satan after regardless. And that is on you. And we are here to testify to that effect. So these are the people who have not worshipped the beast, not taken the mark on their forehead or hand, and they came to life and reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Came to life, keep in mind this is a vision, and so the idea here, as I understand it, and I realize there are some questions here that I don't think anyone can answer satisfactorily, but it seems to me that what he's seeing is that these saints are given a place of great privilege, and they are honored, and they are esteemed in the heavenly places for their having made this decision. They have to be dead because they were, as it says, beheaded. And so they came to life in the sense not that they were literally resurrected and then brought back to earth, like some of our premillennialist friends say, but rather that they are simply recognized, they're acknowledged, they are given acknowledgement here, and they reign with Christ for this 1,000 years. So while Satan is bound, these people are free. We should say something about Satan being bound. I don't have all the answers on that either. Does that mean that Satan is removed entirely from the picture? Does that mean that Satan is less active than before? Does that mean Satan is curtailed rather than being completely, deactivated, if you will? Okay. And what comes to mind, honestly, in this is just me speaking. You don't have to believe this, but I'm thinking of like a drug lord or something like this that gets arrested and put into prison. That means all his influence as a drug lord just completely evaporates, right? Oh, no, not at all. Because the prison system itself is corrupt. And there's plenty of informants and insiders and deals still going on. He still is able to conduct business, if you will, even though he's sitting in a prison cell. And keep in mind where Satan is being housed, he's in this context, in the vision, he's here on earth in an abyss, in an earthly prison, okay? He is bound, but that doesn't mean necessarily that all his influence is gone. Now, that's just me talking. I might be completely wrong on that, and I will stand corrected if someone can pull out a verse that tells me I'm completely wrong. But for the sake of looking at it in a different way than just that he's completely immobilized here. That might be something to consider.
He may be bound, but he still has followers.
That's right. He still has followers and demons that are very much active. Yeah. So even though you bind the captain, doesn't mean that, you know, that everyone else just fades away. And that's not to say that God is limited in what he can do. It's not that. It's just that Satan is, you know, he is the ringleader. So he's not going to be able to deceive the nations in the same way that he did, personally. All right? So there's that. Keep in mind what we have here. Let me write it out this way. Because it's sometimes easier to draw things. Let's draw and make things go away. Okay. So we have here a timeline. We have Satan being bound, whatever that literally means or whatever that officially means there. He is bound for this 1,000 years. And we're using 1,000 years in quotes because it's not a literal 1,000 years, but it is a long period of time, right? And then at some point, he is going to be released. And then when he is released, he is going to have a limited time before the final judgment, his final judgment, that is. Okay, and so in that period of time is when he is active once again. And what does he do when he is active? He goes out to do the same thing that he did before. trying to deceive the nations. Obviously, the nations have changed during this great period of time that he's been bound. So we're not expecting him to go to Rome and deceive the Roman Empire, because there is no Roman Empire, right? And most of the nations, in fact, or countries that were in the Roman Empire, they've either disappeared or changed or been absorbed into other nations. So there is that to consider as well. So that begs the question there, and that is, when is this active time period? When is that? So what I say here in the notes, Satan is going to be released. This shifts John's vision forward until after the 1,000 years are over. And it is important to note, as I say here, that this has no historical point of reference. In other words, he's not saying when he's released, when this other nation has come to be, or like in Daniel 2, in the days of those kings, like it said of the Messiah coming, or in the Roman Empire, when it came. There's no historical point of reference. The only thing you know is that Satan has been bound for a long time, and then he's going to be released. That's the only thing you know for certain. Make sense? Y'all with me? Okay. So, having said that, and that gets to when the 1,000 years are completed, Satan will be released, and as I said, will come out to deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth. Gog and Magog are not literal nations. I know Hal Lindsey, in his book, The Late Great Planet Earth, back in the 1970s, trying to think of the exact date, 77-ish, okay, he said that the one was China and one was Russia. Why does he say that? Because he wants to. I mean, honestly, there's no reason. He just plucked it out of thin air. One is China and one's Russia. Because in his day, those were the two dominant, you know, anti-Christian nations on the earth. They still are, but that's not the point. The point is that he thought all this was talking about, you know, in 1977. Well, there's no reason to say that necessarily, except that Gog and Magog do represent. And if you have to go back to Ezekiel 38 and 39, where Gog and Magog are first mentioned, and they're described in essence as the great horde of humanity, the nameless, faceless mass of humanity that stands opposed to God. And so those nations, whatever those nations are, will be gathered together for war. The number of them is like the sand of the seashore. Another way of saying there's going to be a lot of them, a lot of people who are going to stand opposed to God in that context there. Okay, Jim? Right.
We get boundaries in our heads, and it kind of, try to fit that in there, right? But I don't see that. I'm listening to what you're saying, and it's more about humanity and where people.
It's about a condition of people rather than a geographical boundary or a political boundary. It's a condition of people, a mass of people who have conspired together against God. Doesn't matter what country they're from. Doesn't matter, what time zone they're in or what skin color they are. It doesn't matter. All that is irrelevant. They all have one conspiracy, one united conspiracy, and that is to oppose God. And that's what's important for us to see that, see there, okay? Before I get any further in that, I did want to come back to what I skipped over here. The rest of the dead did not come to life until the 1,000 years were completed, meaning, and the rest of the dead is difficult to know exactly what he's saying. He's talking about, I say here, the first resurrection is spiritual, and maybe this is referring to a bodily resurrection. In other words, the resurrection at the end of time. I'm not really sure. I have to be honest. I'm not sure what that is referring to. It does say, blessed and holy is the one who has a part in the first resurrection. So there's two resurrections. One is spiritual, and if I'm correct, one is physical. One is spiritual in the visionary context of what John is seeing. The other one is a resurrection of the person, which is what Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 50, 1 Thessalians 4, what Jesus talked about himself, in the book of John. In John chapter 5, verse 28 and 29, for example, this is Jesus talking, do not marvel, for an hour is coming in which all those in the tombs will hear his voice, will come forth. And he's talking about a resurrection. He's talking about a bodily resurrection. This is not figurative language. Okay, the tombs are not figurative. The calling is not figurative. The those who come forth are not figurative. There's nothing in this context that suggests that this is a spiritual or visionary context. Quite the opposite. So he's talking here about an actual resurrection. Now, is that what John is referring to when he talks about the second resurrection? In my opinion, it is. I just can't prove it, probably to everyone's satisfaction. But for what it's worth, that's where I'm at with that. Okay? I wanted to say something else, and that is premillennialism. Remember, premillennialism is all about that we are in the premillennial, pre-1,000-year period of time. Okay? And so Jesus is going to come and reign on earth in Jerusalem in a newly built temple for 1,000 years. And somehow, while Satan is bound, Jesus will be reigning. Anyone figure that out yet? Okay, I haven't either. It doesn't make any sense to me at all. First of all, it doesn't say anything about that. But if you read any book on eschatology that's written by premillennialists, if you go into the end of time section at your local Christian bookstore, which, by the way, good luck finding one anymore. If you go in that section there and you read 95% of the books there, it will tell you that Jesus is going to reign on earth for 1,000 years. Where does that come from? It comes from reading that into the text that we just read. And what they're saying is that the thrones are going to be set up for the saints on earth with Jesus reigning in Jerusalem for 1,000 years. That last part is nowhere to be found, but they have to put that in there because otherwise it doesn't work for them. So this is where we talk about people who go to school at MSU making stuff up, right? And they're just plucking things out of thin air. And I don't mean to ridicule them, except that it is ridiculous what they come up with sometimes. It's just almost like, well, we need something to make this work, right? What's the old Latin phrase? Ex Deus Machina, I think is how it's pronounced. Is that correct? Is that the right pronunciation? It means out of the machine, God out of the machine. And it's what fiction writers would use, especially Greek fiction writers, playwrights would use to fix an unworkable situation. They would suddenly have a supernatural appearance by a god to rectify a situation that the playwright got themselves into. It couldn't be fixed any other way. And that's exactly what we have in premillennialism. They can't fix their problem any other way by just literally having, you know, a divine oracle being cast into the middle of this. It's the problem is that God didn't give that divine oracle. They came up with it on their own. This is what's so frustrating about dealing with people and the book of Revelation. It's not that the book is so hard itself, and it's not that people are stupid. It's just that people have been listening to and conditioned by that mentality for so long. And then it's really hard. You almost have to deprogram the one in order to reprogram the truth, get the truth into them. You know, Matt was talking about that. He'd rather have someone that didn't know anything about God rather than someone that's been immersed in denominationalism all their lives. And I agree entirely. Give me someone that's completely ignorant on the Bible. I would much rather have that than, say, pick one, a Presbyterian who's been, you know, a Presbyterian for the last 40 years or something like that. Because you got a lot of work cut out for you there in that latter one. So I just want to say all that before we move on, that that is what's believed about that passage. It does not say any of that. But it does say at the end of the 1,000 years, Satan will be released. He'll be deceiving the nations once again. And the specific reason for, the purpose for the deception of the nations will be to attack God's people. And keep in mind, Satan doesn't come out of the pit, so to speak, deceiving a bunch of, innocent, godly-minded people. These people have already been deceived. And we'll talk about that next week. He's talking to people who have already been deceived. They just need a leader, in essence. That's all we have time for tonight. And we'll take a little break and then shift gears.